From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Our first guest this morning, Edward Posnet. He writes about nature, markets, and trade. He became fascinated with the Icelandic tradition of eiderdown harvesting, which he wrote about in an award-winning essay. That inspired him to write about other harvests, which offer similar intrigue and wonder about the natural world. And he's now written a book about these harvests found in some of the most far-flung locales over the entire globe. His new book is called Strange Harvests, The Hidden Histories of Seven Natural Objects. Edward, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, you have a bit of an interesting background. You started out in financial markets. Somehow that was boring for you. I can't imagine why. And you found yourself in Iceland, and you became obsessed with this notion of eiderdown harvesting. Can you just give us a little bit more to that story?
Sure. So my first job after university was working for a large financial services firm, actually working as a writer. So writing about markets and companies and transactions. And I found that job interesting in its own way, but I felt that I very much wanted to write about what was going on the ground and to write about the natural world and to have some sense of texture and connection with the things that I was writing about. And after I left that job, I came across a story which I just absolutely fell in love with and that was the story of eiderdown, or specifically eiderdown harvesting in Iceland, which for me is a remarkable example of symbiosis, of balance and cooperation between the human and non-human worlds, and something quite exceptional. So I fell in love with that story and then started looking for other stories which offered similar promises, and I wanted to investigate them and see if they were quite as good or quite as interesting as they seemed.
Mm. So a great story about how the natural world finds balance with the economies of trade and finance, and how we preserve that, and that's part of what your book is about. But let's start off with the eider, which, you know, when we talk about down feathers, I have always thought it was goose down. I didn't even know that an eider is a duck. And so talk about the harvesting of the eider feathers.
Sure. So eiders are very large sea ducks, which you find bobbing close to the Arctic Circle in the ocean. And in my book, I write that they're almost more penguin than duck. They're very, very large, robust creatures. They have to survive very cold temperatures. And they build their nests from their down. So during the summer, they actually go to Iceland in their thousands. And they pluck their breasts and build what I describe as rather large furry omelets made from their down. And they lay their eggs into these nests because it's an absolutely wonderful insulator. And the ducklings must survive in very, very cold temperatures. And what's extraordinary is that in Iceland, for centuries, local farmers have really gathered this down without harming the ducks. They actually remove part of the nest either before the ducklings have hatched or afterwards. And for me, it was just a remarkable example of symbiosis. Most of the down that survives us, that surrounds us, is, as you've said, actually comes from dead creatures, from dead birds. And actually, this down is harvested without harming the ducks. And indeed, a case can be made that actually the ducks benefit from this particular arrangement, because what happens is the Icelanders protect the ducks from their predators, such as Arctic foxes or gulls. And over centuries, the ducks have somehow learned, actually, that they will get protection from farmers. So they end up actually nesting close to farms and almost behaving like domesticated fowl.
Is it fair to say that one of the central themes of your book is predicated on cooperation rather than domination?
That's right. So that was really the key question that dominated my thinking during this period. So in the city, I'd written a lot about extractive industries, about oil and gas, about the way that we get fossil fuels, and also about the meat industry. And quite consciously in this book, I was looking for examples of symbiosis where you could take something from nature without actually harming it, or at least that was the offer or the promise of each of these objects. I should say that rarely do they actually live up to that promise. So all of the chapters and all of the objects that I look at all offer a different kind of relationship. And eiderdown, the example I just gave, is really the first example of that. But what tends to happen and what I found is that actually the real situation is often more complicated than it seems. For instance, in the example of eiderdown, the reason why the Icelanders have such a special relationship with these ducks is because they kill all their predators in quite a ruthless way. So actually it's not quite as utopian as it first appears.
So that's the dark side of eiderdown harvesting.
That's right. It is a bit of a dark side, and it's not quite as dark as it was. I think in the 1960s and the 1970s, eiderdown farmers were much more extreme as they were now, and they would kill ravens in their thousands. And some people have even said that they killed sea eagles, which were once endangered. They're now recovering in Iceland. So certainly it did have a bit of a dark underbelly. And the whole system of harvesting was really predicated upon favoring one species over another. And I think most Icelandic harvesters strike quite a good balance, but if they take things too far, they could end up creating a form of monoculture.
Well, let's move on from the eider, the penguin-like duck, to this word that has eluded me. Is it a civet, the cat?
That's right, yes.
Okay,
that's perfectly pronounced.
Okay, great. And it's a type of cat, but its classification is somewhat nebulous, would that be fair to say? But what it produces from a certain pouch or gland near its anus is kind of where the story is.
That's right. It's perhaps the strangest story in the book, and in some ways that's the most repulsive.
Yeah.
But also quite intriguing. So civets are small cat-like creatures, and actually, as you say, historically it's been very difficult to classify them. Some people thought they were badgers, dogs, or actually cats, but actually they belong to their own family, the vivarids, I believe. And in Indonesia, it's said that these particular creatures have a special ability to choose the finest coffee cherries. They're almost like champagne connoisseurs, one harvester told me. And at night, they gorge in the wild on these coffee cherries. And they digest these coffee beans, infusing them with their enzymes and digestive juices. And it's said that the coffee beans that come out, that you can find in their scats, have a particularly special flavor. I would dispute that myself, having tried it. And actually is considered to be a delicacy among some people, and over the last 20 years or so, there's been a bit of a boom in these particular beans. And the story interested me because it seemed to offer the prospect of a symbiotic relationship with these creatures, that these scats could be foraged in the wild without harming them. The truth, however, is very, very different, and actually most of this particular coffee comes from caged creatures because harvesters found it much easier to produce civet coffee intensively.
Ah, that's fascinating. You know, I every so often my really strong coffee smells, I call it like, it smells almost like a skunk. But like the liquid that comes out of the digestive juices of a cat-like creature, now that's something else entirely. You know, I'm wondering about when these trends sort of take hold in a market that's much bigger than, you know, the tiny one in the locale that it came from. What happens? And, you know, and I just think of the example that I come up with, which is quinoa, because we all know about quinoa, right? But they've been eating quinoa in South America for centuries. And it certainly seems to benefit, but then exploit, and then maybe corrupt. And so I'm wondering if you can address that, maybe as it relates to civet coffee from Indonesia?
I mean, it's such a good question that you've raised, and really it's at the heart of the book. I was intrigued by the relationship between these small and quite vulnerable communities on the periphery, often in very remote places, and how they interacted with distant consumers, often in cities, and what happens when you have a scarce natural resource that is subject to a boom in demand. And all sorts of things can happen. I found actually that the market plays a kind of dual role. Sometimes it can have positive effects. It can produce employment, and it can allow people in remote communities to live off the land and stay in these very remote places. But it can also cause untold destruction. In the case of Civic Coffee, when there was a boom in demand for this particular commodity, really in the 1990s, it really transformed the method of harvesting. So previously, I think most consumption was probably local in Southeast Asia. It was carried out by farmers maybe collecting scats on a small scale basis. But once it became a bit of a fad, harvesters found that actually they could form some kind of an industry, and they could start caging these creatures in large quantities, and that if they solely fed them coffee cherries, they could produce quite a valuable commodity. So the market here, I think, in terms of animal welfare, definitely had a very negative outcome. You know, some of the harvesters might say, actually, we've managed to make some money. I actually found Civic Coffee very hard to research, because actually harvesters are very reluctant to speak to people, because there's been quite bad press recently. And there are plenty of examples of this in the book, plenty of negative examples. The other one I talk about is bird's nests, or edible bird's nests, which are harvested in caves. And during the 1990s, there was a similar boom in demand, and these caves were ransacked. But there was quite an interesting technological innovation, because entrepreneurs, instead of harvesting from caves, they found that they could create bird hives and actually draw the particular bird that produces these nests, which are very valued in China. They could draw them to human structures. So I find the market has this sort of shifting dual role, and I find it very hard to come up with, I suppose, fixed maxims about the relationship between markets and these remote communities.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Edward Posnet. He has written a book, Strange Harvests, The Hidden Histories of Seven Natural Objects. Edward, when Lynn and I read books and prepare for our interviews, we oftentimes try to get a feel for the author because you can hear the author's voice and you get a feel for the type of person that they are. And it's just hard for me to believe that you were in finance in London's Canary Wharf. I just can't see you in finance.
You probably aren't the only person to say something along those lines. So it really was the first job after university, and I just wanted to learn as much as possible about the marketplace. I should also say that I was a bit of a fish out of water, because I was someone who worked with words. I was a writer surrounded by accountants and consultants and traders, financial specialists, whereas I'm very much a generalist and driven by curiosity. So you're right in that sense. I wasn't entirely comfortable there, but also I was very grateful for the opportunity to learn about these big questions. And actually, the book really wouldn't have emerged without that experience. I think often there's a point of contrast, because so many of these objects that I write about are so different from the markets that I was writing about in Canary Wharf.
And just a final question on civets. Can you describe what this cat or cat-like animal looks like?
It's very hard to do. And lots of zoologists and writers have struggled to do so. And there was an English Renaissance writer called Edward Topsell, and I think he described it a bit like being a badger or a dog and a cat, a sort of combination of different creatures. I would say it most resembles a cat crossed with a hyena, and palm civets sometimes have stripes, which are a little bit like hyenas, but they're quite small. They've got long tails, and they're very agile, and you often see them walking along branches or along man-made structures. So that's what a civet looks like.
Wow.
Well, let's move on to the next creature, the vicuña from South America, not unlike the alpaca or the guanaco or even a llama, I suppose, more common, at least in North America. But the vicuña is this beautiful little animal with these gorgeous eyes, and its fiber was revered by the Incas. Can you talk about that? And you know, you went there to research the vicuña, but also at the same time, I would imagine the bat guano in from Peru. So maybe talk about those two and what sparked your interest there to begin with.
So you're right. I actually researched two commodities in Peru, very, very different commodities. One was this very fine fiber from these camelids, these wild, beautiful camelids called vicuñas. They are the wild cousins of the alpaca and the llama, those two creatures being the two domesticated animals of South America. The other commodity I looked at was guano, not actually from bats, but from seabirds, which was a great global commodity in the 19th century and is still harvested today by the Peruvians every year on a chain of islands off the coast, and it's used as an organic fertilizer. And what interested me about both of these commodities is that there seemed to be the same possibility offered in both of them as with eiderdown, that actually these particular materials could be removed from the natural world without doing undue damage to the organisms that produce them. So what actually happens with the vicuña is that you find very high up in the Altiplano, in the high plains, and in the Andes, is that actually local people round them up every year in a sort of reimagining of an old Incan tradition, or what's said to be an Incan tradition called the chacu. And people in their hundreds will go out with a long rope and try and round up these creatures and then do something extraordinary. They will shear them live. So instead of killing them, which, you know, has often been the typical means of obtaining fiber from these creatures, they shear them live. And it's a very complicated and difficult operation to carry out, which also, I should say, causes quite a lot of stress to the animal in question, although some have asserted that it doesn't cause long-term harm to the animal. And this fiber is sold on the international market, and it makes very expensive and high-end clothing, actually, which you can find in the United States, and has proved in some cases to be a valuable source of income for local communities in Peru. And I spent a lot of time with one particular community in Pampas Galeras, which is one of the vicuña reserves. So that was vicuña fiber, very different from guano, which is this extraordinary substance, which actually it would be very hard to really recognize as being excrement. It almost smells like ammonia or something chemical. And in fact, when people first came across it in the 19th century, these very large deposits of guano off the coast of Peru, they actually thought that it was a mineral. They found it impossible to believe that actually birds could have built such mountains. And I spent time with a group of harvesters who actually try to extract guano on a sustainable basis on these islands. It's very, very hard to do. Hundreds of men go out every year and live on these islands, which don't receive any rainfall and have huge populations of birds. And they try and get this guano without scaring away all the bird life, which is an enormous challenge. So those were the two journeys in Peru, which both raised very interesting, quite different questions.
Mm. Going back to the vicuña, what is the difference between, because I think that the fiber from the vicuña is more expensive than any other fiber that you'll find in the world, but what is the difference between that and the fiber from an alpaca? And are they harvested in the same way that while it may produce some anxiety in the animal, it doesn't do them any harm?
It's a really good question. So essentially, a vicuña is, there was some debate about the exact relationship between a vicuña and an alpaca, but a vicuña is a wild alpaca. An alpaca is a domesticated vicuña. So when we think about alpaca fiber, it will be presumably shorn from living creatures in the same way that wool is shorn from sheep. The fiber of the vicuña is much finer because it's a wild creature, and generally what you find when creatures are domesticated, their fiber thickens. So the vicuña fiber is much more valuable. It's also much more difficult to obtain. Vicuñas are very, very skittish. They don't like being near human beings at all, and are absolutely terrified when they're being shorn. So it's a very difficult thing to carry out. It requires a lot of manpower, a lot of thought, a lot of nerve and determination, which is what a lot of these communities have. They're two totally different operations. I would say that the shearing of alpaca fiber is probably closer to sheep shearing.
Edward, when I was in college, I took a course in international economics, and I did a paper in that class on guano. And basically, the paper was about these tremendous schools of anchovies off the coast of Peru that had drifted out far enough so that when the seabirds would ingest the anchovies, they would put their droppings in the ocean versus over dry land, and how that affected the Peruvian economy, and somehow that was tied to the Russian wheat deal. I mean, the guano itself had sort of a interesting effect on a number of different variables in economics. It was it was interesting, but it really affected the Peruvian economy for several years.
That's right. I mean, it was Peru's most important commodity of the 19th century. And in fact, within Peru, that period is known as the guano age. It essentially bankrolled the Peruvian economy for decades. It was the world's most valuable fertilizer, and Peru had the largest deposits of it in the world. It's also the highest quality because off the coast of Peru, it's extremely dry, doesn't receive any rain, so it means that the guano isn't leached by rainfall. As soon as excrement comes into contact with water, it loses its potency. And the reason why Peru had such large deposits was, as you alluded to earlier, it's because of actually the combination of huge bird quantities of birds which feed on the abundant amount of fish, the anchoveta. And this is tied to the amount of plankton that there is and the Humboldt Current. And it's sort of a tragic story in some ways because guano really provided extraordinary economic growth. But of course, the supplies of guano were limited. So, you know, by the 1870s, actually, most of the deposits had been removed. And it caused an ecological collapse, but actually all of the birds were frightened away, and it's really taken to be a case study of the negative effects of resource extraction. And what drew me to the story of guano today is that the Peruvian government in the early 20th century decided to try and rebuild that industry, but along sustainable lines. They did a lot of research into the amount of guano that's produced by living birds, and they found that actually if you protect living birds, then they can produce a decent amount of guano, which actually can be harvested on a sustainable basis.
Well, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, one of the items we're talking about is civet coffee, which is a cat-like animal, ingests coffee beans. Its excrements are then, with the coffee beans still intact, I guess, are harvested and roasted and made into coffee. So I just have this one question about that. And you know, what inspired someone to start trying this? I mean, how did... It's an angle that it doesn't seem very obvious to me, you know, to be trying cat excrement in a brewing a coffee. I mean, how did all this happen?
It's such an intriguing question, and actually it's a question you could ask of several of the other commodities. Does someone think this was a good idea? Why did some start eating bird's nests made of bird mucus? Why did someone think that it was a good idea to eat the scats of civets? So the story that we have about civet coffee is that I think in the 19th century, during the period of Dutch colonization, it's said, and we can't be sure about this, that local farmers on coffee plantations weren't actually allowed to brew or make their own coffee from coffee on these plantations. So they instead turned to essentially what was a kind of offcut, if you like, these waste coffee beans instead. And the legend is that it was a local tradition, and I think it is possible actually that so that coffee does have a particular flavor. Whether it's a pleasant flavor is very much a question of personal taste. So there is some evidence that that's how it started, and it was only in recent decades that it became, I suppose, an international commodity. And for me, that transition is quite interesting. You know, why is it that suddenly people think it's a good idea to drink this particular coffee? And I suspect it's due to the saturation of the coffee market, the fact that people are always looking for novelty, that maybe they're a little bit, you know, bored of the standard options of Robusta or Arabica coffee. It's very difficult to answer these questions with a degree of precision, but I suspect that's where the answer may lie.
Well, Edward, we don't have any time left, but I just wanted to mention that after trying the Civic coffee, you promptly discarded it and went to the one place in the world where it makes a lot of sense after you've had some bad tasting things to go to Italy. And there you found a little mussel that produces a mussel-like shellfish, I guess, that produces silk. And that is the next part of your book that is so intriguing. And unfortunately, we've run out of time. So I want to just thank you for joining us today on Cool Science Radio. The book is Strange Harvests, The Hidden Histories of Seven Natural Objects. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.